If I woke up tomorrow and every single dream of an artist I accomplished, it would be first the most amazing moment of my life, and immediately after, a pretty dark spot.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Cloud Machine Podcast. My name is Matt Landry, and in this 71st episode, I'm here with Andrew Mansfield. Though the podcast, we discuss artist management, his professional path, how an artist should grow their career in 2024, working at Universal in their marketing department to now at Full House Management, the music industry, and much, much more. We also play the Dream Fest game. Thanks for listening. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Cloud Machine Podcast, a platform that allows us to learn more about the music industry through conversations with artists, people in the behind the scenes, music business individuals, creatives, and much more. This podcast is brought to you by Eights, a musical direction, playback, and performance company out of Toronto. Our goal with this podcast is to create a resource and library of information on the music industry and to shine a light on all the stuff that is happening in the music world, topics and realities that are gatekept, and the people and roles that may often be overlooked. This week, I have the immense pleasure of welcoming Andrew Mansfield to the podcast. He is an artist manager based out of Toronto with lots of experience, both in and out of the music industry, most notably being at Universal Music Canada for several years in their marketing department, and now at his own company, Full House Management. At Eights, we've recently had the opportunity to work with one of his artists, and through that, we got to know Manny. And again, this is the culmination of a few episodes. We had Dev, we had her band with Zoe and Erica, but now we get to conclude this Dev and Cole frenzy on the podcast with her manager, Andrew Mansfield. So please welcome Andrew Mansfield to the podcast. Hi, Andy, how are you?
What's going on, Matt? I'm good. I'm good. I'll caveat. I have so many different names. I feel like I'm Andrew. I'm Mansfield. I'm Manny. I'm Andy. So feel free to for people listening, they're all me.
Yeah, they're all me. Yeah. If you think I'm referencing other people, though, it's always Manny.
It's always me. Yeah. Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. Let's start the podcast. We always start the podcast by asking you your favorite live experience as a fan ever.
Okay, cool. Favorite live experience as a fan. I have, I think, a couple, and they were from, like, I think there was like an era in my life where going to live shows was like my hobby because I wasn't working in the business. And so it felt so much more, I don't know, unique and momentous. So I think the first one, I went to Bonnaroo for the very first time. In 2018 or so.
Yeah.
And I was a little idiot kid and I pretended I was shooting a documentary, and I snuck onto the main stage and I watched Milky Chance with like a DSLR camera that I didn't know how to use in front of like 50,000 people. So like that was crazy. I'm Milky Chance's music. It's not like I'm a huge fan of him per se, but like that was a wild experience for me as a fan. One other one that I thought was really interesting was this folk, almost Americana artist named Foy Vance, not Vance Joy, Foy Vance, who is from, I believe, Ireland or Scotland, I think. Anyone from either of those two countries would be embarrassed that I can't tell the difference between the two. But, and he's like grew up with Ed Sheeran, kind of like in that songwriting world. And I'm a huge fan of him. And he looks like if the Monopoly Man was a singer songwriter. And
monocle and all?
No monocle, no monocle, but an unbelievable mustache. Okay. And I'm a huge fan of his catalog. He was playing a show at Longboat Hall in Toronto. And we had a hunch that he'd be somewhere backstage, out back, like smoking a cigarette before the show. And we couldn't get tickets to the show because it was sold out. So we like went to the back alley and loitered until he came out to smoke a cigarette. And we ended up like drinking wine and smoking cigarettes with him before the show even started. And then his tour manager was like, yo, we got to go on. Like, I'm not sure what's going on. And he's like, okay, are you guys? And we're like, we don't have tickets. It's sold out. And so we ended up, me and my friends walked out with him. So we went first and like went to the side, and everyone was like, who the hell are these guys? And then he came on and played like a 3-hour show completely solo at the Longwood Hall in Toronto. Wow. That was incredible. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I wanted to ask you about the Milky Chance thing, because we've mentioned it in conversation as well. Was that just like you had a DSLR there? Was it a friend's? Was it just yours? Did you just pick it up? Was that an idea come like in the beginning of it? Like, were you going to Bonnaroo to sort of do that? Or was it just like, I'll just do that?
So yes and no is a lot of kind of answers to it. So there's this... it came from this documentary that I had watched. I'll get into my story a little bit in the past, but I was trying to figure out how to get into the music industry. And I stumbled into this documentary called No Cameras Allowed by this filmmaker named James Marcus. And he was just a student when he did it. And he brought a camera to Coachella and snuck into Coachella, and he took a bunch of photos for like Jay-Z and the Mumford and Sons. And yeah. He kind of like, I don't want to ruin the story. If no one has seen that documentary, go see it. But it was like, wow, this is maybe a way that I can like get into the industry, because it's so hard to get your foot in the door at the beginning. So I bought a camera and convinced a bunch of my friends that this was a great idea. And we started this thing. And so I think like it gave me a reason to buy a $400 Bonnaroo ticket. You know what I mean? But like realistically, we just wanted to go to Bonnaroo, but like we brought this camera with us because we're shooting a movie, mom. You know what I mean? So, so we brought it, and I think like none of the footage is usable. It's so bad quality. The audio is terrible. But it got me onto the main stage to shoot this thing, which was an amazing experience. And yeah, like long story short, it kind of worked. Like I got into the industry that way. The movie will hopefully never see the light of day. but I met a bunch of amazing people and learned a bunch of things as a result. So yeah.
That's crazy. And has that DSLR been to more places than Bonnaroo?
Yeah, it has. It's been, Bonnaroo was the most extravagant place I took that camera.
Right.
And Bonnaroo is not extravagant for people that have been, but I mean, it's interesting. And yeah. I did a couple other local tours. We did some interviews in the city. I'm trying to think of other places, but like realistically, it's seen its time. Like I sometimes pull it out for the Devin stuff recently. And for my other act, Jesse, like I pulled it out. And we've used it, and like it, you know, it's done its job.
Sure.
If I'm shooting, like maybe 5% of the video is actually usable, because I have no idea what I'm doing.
And you say this is the beginning of like your career. Obviously, you were into music, and we'll get into that. But you're saying that this the moment, or the moments with that camera, sort of led you to having a role in the industry. Was there a moment with that camera, or in the beginning, that was like, okay, like sort of like you met this person that eventually led you to working at Universal with that camera sort of thing? Or was it just like when interviewing at Universal, it was like, okay, we did this, and it was almost like a resume piece?
Yeah, a bit of both. There wasn't someone in particular. I mean, like we would shoot. So I think the first realization for me, let's start here, is that I realized a lot of people that are behind the scenes in the music business, and it's kind of hilarious that I'm saying this on the podcast right now, but like most people love opportunities to talk about themselves.
Yeah.
Historically, I am not, but here I am. and so once I realized that the people behind the scenes don't feel like they get, you know, to share their experience, offering them a place to do that, they often just like don't really care if it's real or not, or they don't really fact check. They're just like, do you have a camera and a light? Like that feels legit.
Right.
And so we talked to a couple agents at Feldman at the time, who ended up being our agents at Devin's project. And then I talked to a couple managers, and you know, a couple managers that I work with now. And I tried to talk to my soon to be boss, and he wasn't interested in it at the time. But again, I think like I learned so much that way and met some references so that when I did kind of get my opportunity to interview at Universal, I could like name drop a few people that, you know, I wouldn't say gave me reviews, but did know who I was. And I was able to like, you know, show a bit of, I don't know what the word it would be, but like, I show a passion project that I would like, you know, try and do on my own, and initiative, I think is the word, to try and create something out of nothing. And I think that was relatively interesting. And I remember my boss asking me if he could ever see it. And it was probably an email that I've still never responded to. I was, I'll find it. But
I think it's great. I think like, if I was in their shoes, like it shows initiative, it shows a passion, but also like, again, like you're saying, it's like, it show like it's a foot in the door. Right. And you're able to like, be like, okay, I've contacted you about this. Remember me. Let me get this job.
Yeah. Yeah. People remember names when they see them for the second and the third and the fourth time. So.
That's right. On the podcast, on the Cloud Machine podcast, we do a quote segment. Last year was the Erykah Badu quote, comparing the music as an art form to the music business and how they were similar but also different, and a bunch of different perspectives on that. This year, it's all about this Joni Mitchell quote from 2004, which is 20 years ago. But she says, "I heard someone from the music business saying that they are no longer looking for talent. They want people with a certain look and a willingness to cooperate." What are your first instincts on this 20-year-old quote?
My first instinct on this quote is that though it was 20 years ago, it doesn't feel like it would need to come from an era 20 years ago. I think,
yeah.
Listen, I think it's a disheartening quote from someone like it, that, like Joni or any artist in general, but I don't think it's something that like many industry executives wouldn't privately relate with. I think that there is like inherently a disconnect with commerce and art. And I think there's always going to be a disconnect there because most artists don't necessarily start to make money. They fall into success. Then obviously things change for them. And then also the opposite is also true for executives, that they don't necessarily always get into the music business because they love art. I think sometimes they're like, this is fun, but I can also make money. So, I think everyone would lie and say that this is a terrible quote and that there's no reality to it, you know, in current day and age. But I think with social media, it's a tale as old as time now, which is that like artists need to conform to the way that the industry is running, which is that artists need to do every step of the process on their own. They need to create the art, then they need to market the art. And to market the art, they need to be a content creator. And to be a content creator, you got to put yourself out there on a regular basis. You got to always be present. And I think that quote, in current times, the willingness to cooperate would probably be like, you need to, you know, be ever present on social media and never go away, which sucks. But it is, I think, you know, the reality. But I hope that, you know, we start to kind of course correct a little bit. I think this industry is a weird one where there was this pendulum that swung so heavily in that direction during COVID. And I have a sense that it's starting to swing the other direction, but I'm not quite sure where the equilibrium will be.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting. I think like 20 to 30 years ago, I think all the power in the music industry was like all the artists had the power. And now, especially through COVID and everything, you're seeing like platforms like TikTok and like Spotify and Apple Music, but mostly Spotify, seeing it like have all this power, and artists now need to conform with the systems in place to sort of, you know, be a part of that algorithm and be a part of that system and be a part of that, basically this chain that these consumers are being fed all the time. And also now going part back to what this Spotify CEO said lately about like artists needing to make more content and not using the word music. I think it's just interesting to talk about that. How are you seeing the music business on your part of things, obviously as an artist manager, yes, you are seeing the art part of the business, art part of Devin and Jesse's career, but also just managing their business. How do you see that balance between their art form and the business themselves as a manager of their business?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, I mean, I think a manager's job is unique in the sense that, as I mentioned before, I think there's going to be always a disconnect between art and commerce. I think a manager's job is to kind of navigate that water the best possible. And I think there's no right or wrong answer. Listen, I think I'll get to your question in a second, but I think some artists, if they had it their way, would sometimes, you know, reproduce, rewrite, reproduce forever and ever, amen, and never really get to a finish line. And if a executive wanted it their way, then they'd be releasing demos and be like, it's okay, let's just keep going, like more is, you know, more. So I think as much as there's a bit of a limbo there, and a manager's job is a difficult one, which is to navigate that water, I think there, you know, our job is to try and help come with the best of both worlds and come up with, you know, a product that everyone feels heard and seen, which is ultimately where we want to be. I think your question of like how I see the industry navigating those two things, is that the question?
Well, yeah, I guess just like, how do you see like the business part of your role? I think you're headed down in a good path here. In regards to, okay, let's say your artist is all about the art. How do you manage their business without necessarily infringing on the art?
Yeah, I think the most important thing for me when chatting with artists is the first thing that's really difficult is to have them understand that, like, you know, deadlines are ones that we set.
Yeah.
And though we set them, and yes, we are the boss, and in a lot of cases we can dictate guidelines and deadlines, we need to learn how to hold up our end of the bargain. Like, if we are going to make a promise on a deadline, we need to stay true to it. I think what makes the art a business is being able to continue to move forward and actually teaching everyone around you how to help you get to where you want to go. And I think as a result, like, we have, there's a lot of pressure on us to set deadlines and hit them. And I think, you know, the first instinct is like, you know, well, we set that deadline, so why can't we just push it back? Well, we can, but there's a, you know, there's ripple effects.
Right. And 'cause you're part of the system, really.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I think, like, if you want to develop as an act and grow into a legitimate business where you're making enough money to make a living and pay for, you know, your team around you, your band, your agents, you know, your managers, like, you, there's a, comes a point where you have to start to make money. And I think to make money is trying to manage that transition. So I think for me, the number one thing that I've learned is trying to get the artist to start thinking of things as a business in a sense, but also trying to make sure that they don't lose their creativity through pressure of, now there's a business to uphold. And that's a song and dance, and that there's no right or wrong answer. And that actually, that dance changes on the day, you know? So I think, I think that part is interesting. But I do believe once you can start to respect everyone else's, you know, time and process that's on the project, then you start to realize that everyone's there ultimately looking for the same goal. But we need to learn to give them the tools to succeed on our behalf. And that's a learning curve that is very tough, because it means giving up some things that you may have done for a long time. You know, on the artist side, like, even bringing in mix engineers or producers or master engineers, like, you know, some artists, at least these days, have done that from the beginning because everything is seemingly, you know, much easier for them. And a transition into paying someone to do that work can be tough. Because they're like, listen, I've mixed everything and everything has worked out up until this point, which is true. But also, now that you're at a point where we're trying to grow your business, you have a million other things to focus on. And if you want to focus on the minutia of mixing and mastering, that's okay. But there's going to be a couple other things that we can't do because there's only 24 hours in a day, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? As an artist grows, they also need to learn to delegate as well, and like things like that. But and oftentimes, like the manager is doing that as well, right?
I'm not mixing and mastering though.
No.
I'm terrible at that stuff.
But I hear you talk, you know, until now, obviously it's always been the case, but it's not until now where I've really related to what you're saying to basically what a project manager is when you're talking about deadlines and stuff. You know, it's like, okay, got these deadlines, and your job, from what we're talking about right now, is basically to just meet those deadlines so that in a month we can deliver the project in good standing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know what I'll also say though, that I think I've missed on that last question, is all of those deadlines and business objectives are important, but at what cost? And I realize that like mental and physical health is imperative in this business. Maybe in every business, but more in this business, I would say, than any other. And the reason I would say that is because, like, you know, flow state is something that people talk about a lot. And that's where the best creativity is for an artist. And if there's too much pressure of business on an artist, then it can interrupt flow state. And when that happens, then we're all at a standstill and there's no amount of deadlines or motivational speaking that can get them to where they need to be. So I think it's this really, you know, really interesting waltz that we have to learn, which is when can we pressure to try and hit deadlines, or when is it time to take a break? Nothing else really matters. And so that's my job as well. You know, try and get a pulse on an artist's mental and physical health and try and understand when we should push and when we need to give space.
Yeah. Are there like a specific, everybody has their own things and their own perspectives on this. And I wrote down mechanisms and systems. Do you particularly have mechanisms and systems in place, like with your artists, in regards to, okay, this is when it's just about the music, but this on Saturday afternoon, we do have to take a meeting? Or is it all about like setting expectations with your artists, being like, okay, this in 2 weeks time, we got to do this thing. We got to do it. But you know, the rest of the time it's yours, but we got to really do this thing. Are there things like that? Yeah.
I'd say yes. What I would say though, again, is procedures and mechanisms, all those things are wonderful, but it changes every day. So I think it's kind of checking in on artists, your artists on a regular basis to see how things are going. For example, like if an artist is feeling like they have a lot of capacity to complete whatever it is, then for me, that says, let's do as much as we can in this good period as possible. Because we got a plan for downtime. And so, you know, when it comes to creative space on the writing side, absolutely. Like, you block out chunks and you try and make everyone aware that this is not a time that the artists are going to be, you know, completing specific things. They are focused on the writing process. But you have to plan for those times. It's not like something where you wake up on Monday and you close those doors. So if I know that one of my artists is going to be away for a week, then I have to work backwards and say, okay, what social content is going to be going up that week? And let's get it done ahead of time. What deliverables, you know, we might have, you know, a mix to deliver that week. We may have a photo shoot to approve that week, and that's all fine. But if the artist needs the space that week, then that's something that I need to find windows for in the previous weeks going up into that. Does that make sense?
100%. And I mean, I do it with this podcast as well. If I'm gone or if I'm on tour in a few weeks, I got to do two podcasts ahead or things like that. So I completely understand that. And also every artist is different as well, right? It's like one artist, yeah. A artist might be, you know, might need other things than the B artist or the C artist or the F artist or whatever.
Yeah. And I think every process is different. I mean, I worked with so many artists on the label side that are completely different than the artists that I manage. No one is right. No one is wrong. Everyone has their own process and everyone has their own trigger points and everyone has their things they're great at and everyone has the things that they're not. And I think what makes good managers, but also just executives on the business side, what makes them great is that they don't use a one-size-fits-all solution for every artist. They are able to adapt based on who they're working with.
Fantastic. I want to ask you about some new developments that you're seeing in the industry that you're interested in. Very general question, as in from a manager's perspective, maybe even from a fan perspective. Is there anything that's going on right now in the music industry that you're like, oh my gosh, this is we're going to be looking at this in a few months, or okay, this is cool. You know, are there things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll speak generally. Because specifically, I'm not 100% sure. There are so many little micro moments in this business of like intrigue that, you know, come and pass very quick. My background is very digital. So I focus a lot of my interest on, you know, digital things. I think on the music consumption side, so the fan side, I think I'm genuinely interested in what AI will do for discovery.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how that'll play out. I think, you know, I think AI we've started to see on like the Spotify side. And I'm sure we'll start to see that across other DSPs as well with discovery. But I think what's more interesting to me is like as AIs become personalized to users, I think it'll be interesting if AIs learn to interact with each other. My AI will start to try and shape the algorithm of the AI of the Spotify side, there's going to be this weird kind of like, you know, communication that lives below the surface. I don't know how that's going to work, but I'm interested in where that plays out. I think that's on the fan side, but on the artist side, on the business side, I think community building is going to be, with respect to digital, is going to be interesting. I think one thing that I've, you know, grown up on is community building, at least in my mind, used to be synonymous with social media following. I don't think that's the case anymore. Or I think that maybe it is, but to a lesser extent. Algorithms are amazing for discovery. They are not good at community building. They focus way more on individual videos. As moments in time, but community building is, you know, consistent communication and it's, you know, back and forth between fans and artists. So I think that's probably going to be community platforms that pop up for fans, for super fans that don't rely on algorithm to kind of see content and consume things. I think, you know, maybe a step back in the old days of Instagram where if you followed someone, you'd get all their content. I think that, you know, from a discovery perspective, that isn't helpful. And that's maybe where social media can continue to succeed. But I also think that if someone puts up their hand to be a fan or a community member of a specific artist, they probably do want to see everything. And I think, you know, where that lives, I'm not quite sure yet, but I'm interested in it.
Well, I think we've seen some steps as well towards that, right? In the Instagram, like the channels where artists can like invite you to the channel and be like, "Okay, every message that I send in there, you get a notification." It's like a whole thing. But I think it's really interesting to bring that up. Both the AI for discovery on the artist side, just because we haven't necessarily talked about that lots on this podcast, as in how AI not will impact the musical creation side and all things, but how it'll help consumers sort of get the music that AI thinks that they need or they want. You also mentioned, of course, the community building. I think it's interesting. Are there current ways that y'all are doing that community building right now and not the Instagram sort of channels?
There is. And there's pros and cons to it. So we use Lalo. Shout out Lalo. I love Lalo for this stuff. I mean, a traditional marketer would call it a CRM. I think it is. I mean, it's email marketing 2.0, right? Like it's email open rates are extremely low. You know, the new generation isn't necessarily associating their personal lives in their email inboxes. So Lalo does a really good job about moving, you know, their personal interests into Instagram DMs, into text-based formats, which I think is great. And as a start, it also allows for you to have, you know, more direct contact with your fans. But I don't think it's quite there yet. I think the disadvantages to Lalo is that it's a lot of upkeep to keep communication with every single fan. And I think, you know, a benefit of it, like of a Discord, for example, is wonderful because it brings everyone, all the fans into a group together where yes. communication between fans builds community, which I think is great because an artist doesn't need to be ever present for a community to build. Whereas in Lalo, it is a lot of the onus is on an artist to continue the communication. So I think from like a workload standpoint, a Discord is a beautiful way of building community. Mm. But Discord has a brand. It has a tinge to it, you know? And I think that's not for everyone. Not every artist wants to participate in a Discord channel, which I completely understand. And if you're going to drive your fans into a Discord but never be present there, then is it really providing a benefit or is it starting to provide a disservice?
Yeah.
So I think it's, you know, those are two examples of, I think, platforms that do some things well and some things not. And I think I'm not really sure. I think it'll continue to evolve. I think those platforms will probably steal features off of each other, which is great. Yeah, those are two examples, I think.
That's fantastic. I wanted to get briefly into the origin story in your path. Can you give me a lowdown on where you grew up and your creative upbringing?
Sure. Yeah. Sure. I grew up in Ottawa, Ontario, which is the capital for people that don't live in Canada. It is a very small city comparatively. But I grew up there. My parents were both definitely my mom was musical. My dad was a huge music fan, but I was a really slow learner, still am. I think I didn't realize how like musical my family was until like I started to decide I wanted to be in the music business. Which is kind of hilarious. But my dad, you know, was the one that put on all the music growing up. He was like Eric Clapton, Bruce Springsteen, Phil Collins, Chuck Berry. Bands like the Eagles, the Doors, Americana, America. We listened to that stuff all the time. We had like a portfolio of CDs in our like Cherokee we drive around. And so I think I like consumed music that way. My mom, though, I didn't realize. I'll tell you this one quick story. I was like rifling through CDs of my dad's, you know, cases one weekend. And I found a CD with my mom's name on it. And I was like super confused. I put it in the, the at-home stereo system, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And like heard my mom's voice singing. And I didn't even know she sang. And my mom came like screaming downstairs to come turn it off. She was extremely embarrassed. And I didn't realize like my mom had recorded an EP of covers when she was in university. And you know, I think she like pressed like five CDs and one of them was in this thing. So I think like from a musicianship, musicality, my mom was, you know, the singer and the instrumentalist, but like was shy and reserved. My dad just consumed a bunch of music. And I think that's kind of where it started for me, but I didn't, again, it took me so long to like realize that music was in my blood, honestly, to like third or fourth year of university. So
yeah,
that's my like quick story there.
That impact is so underestimated. And, you know, I go back to like a lot of the guests on this podcast are always like, oh man, like it seemed like I didn't have a lot of musical influence because my parents didn't play any musical instruments, but they were like the biggest fans of music. Right. And like I always think that's almost not necessarily better, but almost equal as having instruments in the home, because, you know, it can be always on. It can be on when, you know, you're doing your morning routines or after school or outside on the deck or whatever, on the pool, at the pool, whatever it is. I just think it's really great. And specifically for you, you know, discovering later on that they are the reason why you're doing this as well. Right.
Right. Right. Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I mean, I was reading Alicia Keys, one of her books, and she was saying the same thing that I think, you know, she didn't realize until she was, I mean, much earlier than me for the record, but like, she might've been like 10 or 12 and she didn't realize that like music was always playing in her household. And, you know, eventually when you start to understand that you can have your own thoughts and opinions, you start to actually look at all these years of like, you know, subconscious impression of music. And you're like, wow, I didn't realize that the stuff I like and the stuff I want to sing and the stuff I want to write is, you know, some of its parts of all the music yes. that I've heard over the last 10 years, which I think is super interesting. So
it does.
I'm a bit like that.
Through that music in the home, maybe music in school and everything. Do you remember a story of something that really changed how you saw things in regards to your professional career? As in, maybe it was a story of like, oh my gosh, I can really do this. This is actually a career I can go down. Or, you know, you saw maybe a friend or a family friend that was doing it for real and was like, hey, this is legit. I could actually do this if I wanted to.
Yeah. It was in fourth year university. I remember the exact time. It was in fourth year university. I was at university or college in Canada at Queen's University. And I was sitting in this cafe that I used to work at least I didn't work much in university, honestly, but I used to go there and pretend to work. And everyone was applying for jobs. And I was, you know, going to graduate with economics degree and I was going to go work for like a bank or something.
Right.
And I remember reading some articles online about the touring business and all the different people that go into a touring business. I can't remember the exact article, but it hit me in that moment that there was, I swear to God, like it was, I would have been 19 or 20. And only then was I like, well, there's people that work in the music business that aren't artists. And that feels like a crazy concept to me that I'd never thought of, which is again, only embarrassing in hindsight. But so I emailed a bunch of people that work at studios in Toronto being like, hey, I'm graduating. I have an economics degree, like some sappy email about my dream now is to work in the music business. And they all replied being like, sure, I guess, dude, like if you want to come, if you want to come like see the studio, you can. Right. And I was like all excited and like amped up. And one of the notes I sent was to a guy that I work with now at Live Nation. And he was a promoter on the festival side. And he was like, if you want to come meet me, you know, that's fine. And yeah. So I put on a suit, which is ridiculous for anyone that's going to a music industry meeting, unless it's at an attorney's office, probably not even them. Like, don't put on a suit. I put on this like gray suit with a flashy red tie and trained my way into Toronto, went to the Live Nation head office and met with this guy. And like everyone's in like ripped jeans and baggy t-shirts and ball caps. And I'm sitting there in this stupid suit that I've never worn before or since. And I like picked this guy's brain for an hour and he was so gracious with me and gave me, you know, an hour of his time to tell me a bit about the festival business and the Live Nation business and the promotion yeah. business. And I went away being like, this is it. Like, this is what I want to do. And at the time, the Live Nation office was right above the Molson Amphitheater. And so for people that are not from Toronto, it's like this big, it's one of our only big outdoor amphitheaters in the downtown of the city. And so you're like sitting in this office overlooking, you know, 10,000 seats plus a lawn that does 30,000 capacity. And you're like, wow, this is crazy. Like this is the dream. But yeah, I mean, that was kind of when it started for me. Shout out Mark at Live Nation. And that's kind of when I really wanted to get going into it. But it took me a while to get there.
Yeah, no, that's great. At eights, and you know, on this podcast, we love relationships and stories of relationships. You mentioned that Mark was one of the first people that you met in the industry, and you're still working with him today.
Mark Russell and I. We had a conversation at Devin's sold out show the other day, and we're just sitting shoulder to shoulder, and I was like, "This industry's wild, so weird." Anyway, I cut you off. Go ahead.
No, it's fine. I just wanted to just mention quickly, and we're going to talk about it a little bit later, but like, what do connections mean to you in regards to, you know, in the early parts of your career? And is there another person other than Mark that really like marked your, or had a big impact on your early development in the music industry?
Yeah, for sure. His name is Fraser McKenzie. I'm sure, I don't know if he'll see this, but he's my guy. He gave me my real first chance in the music business when he was my first boss at Universal Music. And okay. I think as I went on to work at Universal, you know, you realize how important having some sort of music industry experience is. At least everyone can learn, but like, how fast you learn relies a lot on, you know, what kind of knowledge or experience you have. And, you know, my Coles Notes story before Universal is like, I went to go work at, you know, I was going to work at a bank, and then I decided to work on the advertising agency side of RBC. And that was like, you know, a little bit of a step into the creative side, but still in banking. And then I moved from there to work on the Red Bull account at a different agency. And Red Bull at the time was doing all kinds of stuff on their culture project. So like they were doing, you know, RBMA, which is all focused on the producer side. They were doing like 3 days in Toronto, which is like the Toronto version of 3 days in LA. And we're doing Sound Select and all of these artists that they were working with at the time, you know, Bad Bad Not Good, Daniel Caesar, Jesse Reyes, Charlotte Day Wilson. And so that's kind of like where I got a little bit of experience. And then when I finally interviewed with Fraser McKenzie at Universal Canada, he gave me my first shot. And he was like super patient with me. And I was, you know, over keen is not even a word, but I was overexcited about everything, not really, you know, just like move fast and break things type vibe. And he was kind of like very patient and walked me through it. And he's been around for a very long time in that building and still is. So he was like the first guy that really gave me my chance. And he's an unbelievably smart, hardworking dude. So if he sees this, shout out Fraser McKenzie.
Great. Yeah, let's talk about your first role at Universal. Talking about Fraser McKenzie, what was that first role like, and what did it give you?
Yeah, well, it gave me everything. It was weird though, because it was marketing, but it was in digital. And at the time, there was Fraser McKenzie, Zoe Badley, and I. So there's three people on the digital team,
right?
Which is when we were running the entire, you know, digital portion of the business. This was like. Yeah. And so this was like, you know, TikTok was a platform, but I don't think anyone was on it.
Right.
And, you know, obviously like Instagram was there and YouTube was there, but like we were kind of in the Wild West. Like we didn't really, like our job really was focused on like, how do we build relationships with the people at Instagram? Is that even helpful? Like, how do we build, you know, can we shape Instagram following, or is that just a result of successful records? Like,
right.
Just trying to figure out where we can push and what we can actually do for a project on the digital side. And you know, there was I think at the beginning it was relationship building with those accounts, with those platforms, and also trying to find any opportunities to pitch artists for. You know, that has come so far. And an example in modern terms would be like trying to get people on those Vivo Discover accounts where, you know, they allow an artist to perform, or Genius, and getting them in front of that yellow wall and like walking through a song. But back then, like, those opportunities were still few and far between, and platforms were discovering on a regular basis. Like, there wasn't even repertoire or catalog on platforms yet. Like, it wasn't like you could go onto Instagram and like choose a sound back then. It was just, you know, us going on, and there was a lot of whitelisting for us at that time. So like, whitelisting is trying to tell a platform that we're going to be putting copyrighted music on, and like, please don't take it down and flag it. And that would be like 80% of our time, which is like, we'd tell an artist, yeah, it's all set up. They'd post a clip, it would get taken down. And like, we would call Instagram and be like, please, this is the artist that's trying to post it. So that was like early days. But, you know, because of that, you get to kind of learn the digital footprint from the ground up and really feel like, you know, you can learn how to drive artist development from a digital perspective. And like, but when I left that company, there might have been like 15 people on that team, 12 or 15, which is like such a crazy growth of a department in 4.5 years, at least in my perspective. And when I left, it was like, you know, that this whole social media momentum of, you know, releasing records, teasing records, turning that into driving consumption was so prominent that it was interesting. The very first time I asked one of my acts to post to TikTok, and like, I would have steered them down such a rogue path of like how to create pieces of content and like what to do. But who's to know that that would have even changed how it performed back then, because the algorithm was weren't even, you know, the same.
Yeah. We've been talking about lots recently about how labels have almost like ditched the concept of a marketing team due to the fact that social media consumers have become hungry with like authentic and like real content from artists. For example, you know, we see a lot of artists now being like in their own rooms, you know, and, you know, doing the whole selfie video thing. Or, you know, for your instance, if I pick directly from your artists with Jesse and Devin, where it's like covers in your in the park, or covers in your living room, or like R&B covers of X artist, or putting your own lyrics on a verse of this other artist. We're just seeing a want from consumers of being like, okay, I want the real thing. I want the real artists doing their own thing. It looks DIY, the whole thing. Now, coming back to the labels part of it, how are you seeing this change in the marketing of it? Because, of course, 80s, 90s, 2000s, big marketing teams, big systems, big machines. And now labels are being like, we'd love to give you marketing, but it's actually you that has to do it. How are you seeing that?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I'll first give credit to one of my artists, Devin, because she has labeled this era you're talking about quite beautifully. And I think in this day and age, there's this development era of all artists that is Devin's quoted as the bedroom era, which is like every artist these days to develop their own following and develop their own momentum has this bedroom era on socials. And you can go back with some of the biggest artists. I mean, Chappell Roan had a bedroom era. Chappell Roan is not a bedroom era artist at all right now, but like, it's not that long ago that she was, you know, at home doing the same thing. And the result is this community, to your point, that feels like they really understand where she came from. And if they don't at the time, they can discover her now and still go back and find those things. So, you know, there's a huge benefit there to feeling inside, you know, inside baseball, if you will, of like, oh, this person started here. They used to do covers of this, and then this is how this song developed. And now they're selling out these festivals and they're playing for 50,000 people. So I think that piece is really interesting. It feels like the veil is kind of pulled back on artists being glossy and untouchable, if you will.
Yes.
Which I think is great. I do think, though, there is a time in an artist development process where that starts to become old news, and an artist does need to grow out of their bedroom era and into the next stage. And there is this, you know, I'll go back to this dancing example, this waltz example, where like you can't make that change overnight. It needs to feel organic. It needs to feel natural. And I think it forces artists to choose that time organically. Like, am I really out on the road touring, or am I still at home in my bedroom? And let's not, sorry for swearing, but let's not bullshit fans. Like, if you're still at home in your bedroom era, let's not pretend you're not there. Let's just, you know, keep doing those things. And I think it'll naturally progress. To answer your questions on labels though, I see both sides, and I am as on the artist side as I am on the label side. And I'll explain what I mean by that. I think to answer your question, yes, labels have become much more reliant on artists to create these videos and promote themselves from a marketing standpoint, create the fire, and then we'll pour gas on it. And in one sense, from the artist perspective, that's extremely frustrating, because you're asking an artist to do everything from first chapter to last chapter: create the art, learn how to market it, create the spark, start the fire, then we'll come in on the 11th hour and pour gas on it. Like, it's frustrating, but there's a silver lining here. I think in the old days, yes, labels used to have huge marketing teams, and they would promote artists themselves and the labels delivery. I just finished Bruce Springsteen's book, and he was like, listen, my job was 6 months in the studio at the record plant in New York. I would deliver the album, and then I would leave for a while and get my tour ready. The label would do their job. And then hopefully by the time my tour is ready and the album is on radio, then we can kind of reconverge and I can go run this thing on the road. But that's a glamorous story. Artists in the past have been shelved so many times because a record isn't working. And, you know, when the artist would say, hey, like, what's next? Like, why am I not going on tour? And why isn't anyone listening to this? They would say, well, you know, the feedback from the radio companies and the press outlets has been that it's not that good, so we're not going to promote it much. And then the artist back then would have been stuck with no options. And in today's era, if a label says, yeah, well, nothing's really working and we're not going to promote it, then the same thing that artists hate is now their lifeline, which is that I'm going to go create the noise myself.
Yes.
And I'm going to tell the labels or show the labels that they've made a mistake in not promoting these records. And so I think is the same thing that's unbelievably frustrating has given a lot of artists, you know, a way out of a tough label situation, which I think is, you know, is an interesting perspective on a difficult qualm.
I think it's very interesting, and it empowers the artist to take over their
Control of their project.
To take control. Yeah,
and it's a lot of work, but
yes,
but it's an option they have.
Yes, and if ever they do get shelved or they get dropped, cross your fingers. If they get dropped, they can still do it by themselves because it's their voice. At the end of the day, it's their bedroom. It's their thing. So it's like you know, they're as empowered, or they're more empowered now for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I go back to that Chappell Roan example. She was signed at 15 to Atlantic. I think she was dropped by 18 or 17. And then it was the pandemic, and she was an independent act with, by all accounts, a failed record deal, but she was too young to understand her project. I'm not going to speak as if I know that project like it's my own, but I'm fascinated by it because she created the Chappell Roan project on her own. And, you know, and then, you know, she's since being re-signed and she has this whole thing. But, you know, in the old days, that development on your own from your bedroom era was impossible. And now she's like, well, if you don't like it, that's fine. I know what I'm great at and I'm going to continue to do that. And we're here. So
there you go. I want to talk about your journey from, or maybe a quick journey, you know, maybe your quick journey from Universal to Full House. What made you decide to take the step from marketing at the time to management?
It wasn't a like a some Machiavellian decision. It was like, it was, you know, 2020, we all got sent home. The music business kind of stopped or at least slowed down. And I was lucky enough not to lose my job. And there had been this girl that had reached out to me on LinkedIn in 2018 when I first got my job. And she was like, hey, I went to the same university as you. And I see that you're in music and I want to get into music. Can you call and talk to me about it? And so I took this call with this first year student named Evan, and we spoke about the music industry a little bit, and I was still relatively naive. And at the end of the call, she sent me 5 songs that she had written, which I thought was hilarious because she was asking about trying to get into marketing, but I think she just wanted me to hear her music. And for the record, I had no like weight in that building. Even if I wanted to get her a record deal, I was like, my very first year there, I knew nothing.
Right.
No one was listening to me, and nor they should have. Like, I didn't know what I was doing. So I think we were both on false pretenses there. But when COVID happened and I was sent home, I reached back out to her and I was like, hey, like, I've learned a lot in the last 2 years. Are you gonna put out some music? And she put out her first single. And we started to kind of pseudo work together then. And then there was a juncture where I needed to choose a side. Like, Devin was doing well, and it looked like, you know, maybe a record deal was in the future. And you know, the politics of record businesses are tough. So I just decided to take a chance and leave the business and start this full time. And I got very lucky. It was like, you know, a month and a half after I left Universal, we signed Devin to Sony, and it was crazy, but it was unbelievably frightening. I mean, I'd say this, that like I said on my resignation letter, that like there's something on the other side of this like immense fear I have, and the fear being leaving this company that I've always wanted a job at. I think there's something on the other side of this for me. I'm not really sure what it is, but I'm going to go try and figure it out. And that was the transition. So I kind of just got thrown into starting a company, and I knew nothing about starting a company, and I still don't really know much about it, but it's been working.
What did that role at Universal, how did that feed your current role with Full House, owning your own company? Are there things that you can specifically say, okay, I did this at Universal, or this gave me that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's so I did a campaign for a single on a band named Valley, and I love those guys. And
of course,
there was a song called Like 1999 that I was working that project on socials with their A&R, Matt Souza, who's an unbelievable A&R. And, you know, we were trying to create content. They had made this unbelievable video from the studio that went viral on TikTok. And at the time, there was no proven success story of, if a TikTok is going viral, then it will equal consumption on socials. It was still very, you know, up in the air and rather rogue. And I think I remember that campaign trying to like, you know, make a call, because that band is super, super well-versed and calculated in their album rollouts, where that they normally make sure a project is ready. Like the artists are, like the songs are done, like there's a rollout plan, then we'll start to promote. Where they had this song that was going on viral on socials. And the argument was, do we put this out and try and get some consumption from the noise? Or is this going to be a misstep because we're going too early before everything else is calculated? And we did it. And I think it's still their biggest song to date. It was like a huge success story for me at that label, and a huge learning of like, okay, we can garner the attention and the discovery of a lot of people on the back of good social short form content. And so that was where I started my management business. Devin and I focused on socials, and we grew a bunch of audience. And then we had a very big viral moment with a song called Witch. And that song you know, did unbelievable things for us. I mean, it kind of just set us as a legitimate business. And this is not a new story now for people that are hearing this. There's a million examples of it. But at the time, it was really interesting. So that was my there's my one example. I know how to recreate this, or at least I think I do. So I'm going to go try it.
It's fantastic. A lot of people say that there are different management styles, at least I see it because I work with so many managers for different artists, but also through this podcast, you know, I see just different perspectives on things. Do you think that you have a management style? And if so, what is it? Or how would you name it?
I don't know if I would have a sexy name for it.
No.
I think I can tell you my management style is probably focused on the things that I'm good at and not focused on the things that I'm not. So for me, my management focus is on audience growth. And audience growth via social content is probably what I'm best at. And so I'm a marketing guy. I mean, I'm not a songs guy. I'm not an A&R guy. I've stolen this quote from, I think, Scooter Braun. I'm sure everyone hates him now, but I don't. I think he had this interesting quote about his ear, which is that like the best thing about my ear is that how average it is. And so it's probably, you know, maybe reflective of the mass. So I can tell you if I think a song is sticky, but I'm not an A&R's guy. So I try and leave the music and the creativity to the artists. They would tell you that I still have opinions that piss them off and I do give them, but I'm not prolific there. I think I'm more of how can we create an audience that online first, then how can we convert them into, you know, fans of you and then ultimately listeners of your music and buying your merch and buying hard tickets. So my management style is much more focused on marketing and not very focused on A&R. I would say, does that make sense?
Oh, 100%. Are there things that you prioritize more as a manager than some of your colleagues?
I guess it's a bit tough for me to say. I have some assumptions, but I'm not in the weeds with other managers that often. I think because I'm a marketing focused manager, I think I prioritize, I try and prioritize like being as present on social media as possible. Within reason. I think one thing I've learned more recently prioritize, and again, it's hard for me to tell you if that's different than other managers, but I try and put a lot of pressure on my artists to own their projects. I think it's really easy for artists to, and this is not harping on them, I just think it's easy for them to start to see teams built around them and they start to become a bit complacent with the output. Like, hey, you know, my job is to create and then someone else is going to do the mix, and you know, or yes, someone else is there to help on the live side and put that together, or, you know, whatever it may be. And I think I'm learning to have artists ask the very hard, challenging questions on their project and make sure that everything that's happening, they understand and that they were a part of a decision. Again, I think making decisions for artists, even though it might save time in the short term, the artist needs to live with that decision in the grand scheme of things. And I want them to be aware on every step of the process of like, you know, we are doing this because we had that conversation, you understood it, and it was a decision that, you know, we made, or we're going to stay to. And that one's tough. I'd say like some artists more than others are very, you know, protective of their project and they want to run everything, which is great within reason. Because there comes a point, like we talked about earlier, where you have to learn how to delegate. And delegating is, you know, sometimes can be seen as hypocritical when I say you need to own your project, but it's not actually. It just means that when we're delegating something, there's been a conscious, thoughtful decision to do so. And we know why we're delegating and we're making those decisions, you know, because we've thought it through versus we're going to delegate because it's easier. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. And there's delegating because you need to prioritize other things. But if an artist needs to delegate something, they should still have their creative vision on it, right? Because at the end of the day, everything represents them. Yeah. And of course, there are things that they can be on and others that they can't, you know, but that's when the trust becomes the happen, or that's when the trust happens between colleagues, the people that you're hiring, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, totally. So again, I don't know if my style is that different than other managers, because I'm not in the weeds, but those are things that I focus on, which again is really trying to get to be as present as possible from a social content perspective. And also trying to get artists to really own some of their decision makings, at least with respect to creative.
Great. What makes a good manager? General question.
Generally, I think it's patience and like unequivocal belief in an artist's trajectory. I think those two things, to me, if I was going to narrow it down, this quote is not mine, but there is one thing that's similar or the same between all successful artists that have ever made it, ever. And it's that they just never stop trying. And I love it because it shows that there really is a process that needs to take place for an artist to get to where they're going. And as long as a manager and the artist both truly believe that it will work, then what that means is that there's just that needs to be time that passes for you to get there. And the only thing that allows a good management artist relationship is patience there. So those are the two things. I mean, listen, there are a million other things that make good managers on the tactical side. You can be a great marketer. You can understand the songs, you know, you can understand the connections and open doors and close others. All those things are important. But I think if you narrow it down, those would be the two things that I'd say.
Fantastic. Any tips for aspiring managers? Maybe somebody that's maybe already in the music business or interested in it. Maybe they're at a label, but want to go into management. Any tips there?
Yeah, I would say like don't wait to start developing an act. I mean, I think it really, I don't want to marginalize an early manager's role, but like developing an act when an act is really new, it really isn't a ton of work. It is like, because there's no bar, there's no expectation of early artists, right? Like you're not on a timeline. So I think finding an artist that you think has potential and just starting to slowly grow with that artist, teaching them the ins and outs about a little bit about the record producing side and maybe a bit about marketing, you can do that like in the same amount of time that you talk to one of your best friends during a week. Like it's not, I think some people look at artist management when they have a full-time job, for example, as like a whole thing of work. And I think in the short term, you don't need to overcomplicate it. Just get started and start seeing if you can help an artist develop. And I think you'll find out pretty quickly if management's for you, or if that artist is one that you feel like you can help. And maybe that goes back to management style. Like you learn what kind of manager you think you are, and then you start to learn as a result what kind of artist you might need to match your style. I mean, some artists don't hate social media, and that's totally fine. That is not an artist that I don't think I can actually help, even though, you know, I think that they should be on social media. If they don't want to be on social media, then I don't think I can provide value. So that might be an easy answer to your question, and I'm sorry if that's not enough to anyone that's listening. But
no, it's great. I want to move to the artist side of management. I want to ask you about when you think it's when you think is the right time for an artist to seek out management?
That's a really good question. It's a really good question. I think when an artist is feeling like they are so busy, and let me say this before I start, busy is a relative term.
So, yes.
busy is not, I'm sorry to be a jerk, but like busy is not, I have to go to school and then I have to work 2 hours every night on my artist project. That's, you're not busy. I'm sorry. Busy is like, I really feel like I can't find the time to do everything that I want to do. And I'm really spending every single second I have on this project. I think then it starts to make sense to find one. But also, I think you have to provide value. There has to be a roadmap for a manager to see. And I think sometimes it takes an artist, you know, to help share that roadmap. I think, you know, it's so tantalizing to focus on the Justin Bieber Scooter Braun relationship, where Justin Bieber didn't really understand that there was a roadmap and Scooter Braun plucked him out of the, you know, the ether and like put him on this thing. But that's just not how most relationships start. I think most relationships start by managers seeing artists succeed on their own. And then an artist, you know, can start to say, I'm really at a place where I've succeeded a lot on my own and I've done everything on my own. And now I'm at a place where the only way I can continue to succeed is by bringing on a manager. So what's the right time? I mean, I've just given you a very vague answer because everything is different. But I think let's focus less on, you know, the metrics, of like, oh, okay, I have a million monthly listeners. Now it's time, because that's not always true. I think sometimes artists are unbelievably focused on it. It's become everything they want to do, and they've shown that they're spending every ounce of time on it. And they have a roadmap, and they can talk to a manager and say that I do have a roadmap, and this is the plan. And if the artist, if the manager sees the same roadmap, then I think it's time.
What can artists do before they get a manager? As in, what should an artist do or try to do before they get a manager?
Yeah, I mean, I think like it always starts with the music. It's a bit of an eye roll, but it's true. Like you need to learn how to develop a sound. And also the technical side. Like, I think you should be relatively well versed in the production of your own music at the beginning. I mean, even if you're hiring someone, sit in the rooms, like learn it. And I think that's extremely important. Producers, which I think are great because the business model is so different than managers, you know, you save up enough money to work with a producer that can produce a couple songs with you. And I think I would encourage artists to sit in and watch those processes. And so, you know, the mix and master process, I think, is important to understand. I don't think you need to necessarily sit in on those per se, but that'd be the first thing. And the second thing, and the most important thing, at least from my perspective, is learn how to develop an audience online through social media. And that part is going to suck. So I'd say the most important thing for you is find a process that is manageable for a very long time. You know, some artists decide they're going to put 10 hours of work into editing one video and then they post it and it doesn't do well. And of course you're burnt out. Everyone would be. So set an expectation that feels, you know, consistent, and you can do it over and over again without feeling exhausted by it. I'll give you a quick example of this where I made a mistake. When I started this stupid documentary, I was trying to create social content, and I created like a format or a template where people were holding these like Polaroid photos. And then I would like superimpose or like Photoshop the actual photo that I wanted onto this like you know, Polaroid image that I found online. And it was like super fun and cool the very first time. And then I realized that like, if I wanted to do three of those posts a week, I had to find three stock images of Polaroid photos and Photoshop it three times a week to get it online, which isn't that much work, but it was more work than I wanted to do. So yeah, just think about content creation from the long perspective versus just for the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. How do artists stand out in today's industry, and specifically to what you were saying, like to me, it's like they need to find their voice. I don't know if there are any tips. Maybe you see tips on that. How do artists find their voice, but also stand out in today's industry? Is it having their unique voice kind of thing? Their unique voice, their unique perspective.
I think so. I mean, listen, standing out, you can do in kind of two ways, right? Like you can do it in the music way. And yeah. I'm not an artist. If I knew how to stand out as an artist, I probably would be one, but I don't, like, you know, music is something that's an artist has to kind of create. I think a personality though, and like a community worth living in, I think is probably how you want to stand out. I think, listen, like, every single, this is a sad reality, but a lot of people on their downtime, like we live in this escapism culture where so many people spend so much time at work or at school, which they don't love. And artists give a venue for regular everyday people to, you know, romanticize another reality. And they get to live vicariously through artists. And therefore, I think you need to create a home for them that feels more exciting than sometimes their own, which is not trash talking some people's reality. I think that's just the reason why people become such big fans of other artists or celebrity in general, right? So how do you stand out? Build a place that's welcoming to a subset of people. And I would say try and build it, you know, in it that's not unbelievably broad, that people don't understand what the community is. But not so niche that no one is involved. I think it's somewhere in between where you, like, you do have a niche or a niche. I've never figured out a great way to say it. But, you know, that it's enticing for people, but, you know, also broad enough that people can bring their friends.
Fantastic. I want to ask you what you are looking forward to.
What am I looking forward to? In my life, or in my career? In my career.
Both.
What am I looking forward to? You know, it's a fascinating question. I've asked myself this a lot. Because a year ago, I would have told you that I'm looking forward to a full sold out tour. I'm looking forward to, you know, being involved in the Billboard Top 100 conversations. I'd be looking forward to, you know, radio play. Sorry. I think what I'm looking forward to, though, is never really getting there. And what I mean by that is, like, I think I've learned to absolutely love the process of chasing. And the chase is so exciting that I think I would love a world where I never quite got to a finish line. And I think the chase needs to be ever developing. It needs to be exciting. It needs to change for sure. But like, if I woke up tomorrow and every single dream of an artist I accomplished, it would be first the most amazing moment of my life, and immediately after, a pretty dark spot. Sure. Because it kind of gets me out of bed in the morning to keep chasing. So what am I looking forward to? I think I'm looking forward to the process that's ever changing and always different. And I think a review mirror is important. I think this is a Jelly Roll quote, which is that the review mirror is smaller than the windshield. Yeah. On purpose, but it's still there. And I think, like, you know, when you get to that point where you sell out a tour and you are playing a festival stage, that's a big one for you. Like, you know, revel in the moment for a second, look at the review mirror for another, and then like keep that process going, because at the end of the day, like, you know, I would hate to accomplish every single thing that I've ever dreamed, because it would kind of be such a bummer to get out of bed the next day.
Fantastic. You mentioned if we asked you a year ago about what you'd be looking forward to, you would say, you know, Billboard 100 Conversations, a sold out tour. I want to ask you about maybe a few pieces of the dream. Is there one thing that you're like, that would be really sick? Like playing one of your artists playing X place, or do one thing that's sort of like, okay, that'd be crazy.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, listen, the festival stuff, like, I mean, Coachella's been in the conversation for years. I think Stagecoach is also there. I think playing like a sunset slot, like at 6 o'clock, kind of set at either one of those festivals would be unbelievable. I mean, there's so many festivals that we'd love to be a part of in that conversation, but stage-wise, like, you know, the Gorge is one that I have always dreamed of playing at and being a part of. Red Rocks is another one of those. This is like, you know, I'm really focused on summer right now, given it's June, but
yeah.
And I think, like, from there are, you know, a couple arenas that we dream of too. Like, you know, MSG is one that, you know, every person has kind of thought about at one time or the other. All of those things would be epic. And then I'm thinking only live, because I feel like, for me, when you go to a live show and you see it, it becomes very real. Whereas when you're sitting behind a computer screen, like a million streams on a song or 10 million streams on a song, you're so desensitized to it. But when you see, like, imagine thinking, okay, 100 streams on a song is so not impressive. But if you know 100 people screaming your song all in the same spot, it's like, whoa, like that's real, you know? So I think a lot of my dreams are wrapped up in live, because it feels like the final piece of a puzzle that has worked up into that point.
Fantastic. Yeah. You mentioned a lot of festivals. I wanted to quickly go into the Dream Fest game, which is a game that we play on the podcast, to wrap up the episode, the Cloud Machine Podcast, 71st episode with
71st, Matt?
Yeah, 71st, yeah.
My God, moving fast.
Oh yeah, it's been a year and a half of one a week. So wanted to ask you about your favorite festival, your dream festival. We talk about dreams, we talk about festivals, we talk about, you know, Stagecoach, Coachella, all these things. I wanted to ask you, if you had the opportunity to program a festival, one night of a festival lineup, three acts, as in a headliner, a middle act, and an opener, who would those be? Where, as in where in the world? What, when in the year, as in, is it summer, is it July, is it August, is it December, whatever? The era, as in if you had to program it, you know, in the 80s, 90s, whatever. And specifically for you, it would be the food and beverage, or food or beverage, that would be served at the festival that would best represent you, as a fun question.
Okay.
So we could take a little bit of our time there, but go ahead.
Can I give you the era of the artist as well as the era that I would love to participate in the festival?
Yes. So this could be, you could do like Beatles in the 60s, but like Beyonce now. This is also dead or alive. So to make it even more complex.
Okay, cool. I think my headliner is Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
His Thriller era. So I guess like the 80s, 1980 something.
Yeah, early Michael 80s, Jackson. Michael Jackson, yeah.
Yeah, that he's headlining. For sure he's headlining.
Sick.
I think supporting him is Kacey Musgraves' Golden Hour era.
Yeah.
I think she's coming out and crushing that record. That was like 2019 maybe for me. And I remember hearing that album, listening to it in its entirety, like first record to last record, and then doing it again and again and again. Anyway, so she'd be my second act. And then I think my third act would probably be current day Sam Fender.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
And I think his like most recent, I mean, I've liked a couple of his albums, but his most recent album, like 17 Going Under, is like so nostalgic Bruce Springsteen vibe for me. Like, and I think of my father and my mom growing up on Bruce Springsteen. That would be probably the opener. So Sam Fender, Casey Musgraves, Michael Jackson.
Fantastic. Where would this festival happen?
I think it would happen at the Gorge in Washington State. Yeah. Fantastic. I think that would be, it'd be outdoors. It would be July.
July for the whole year.
July for the whole year. Shout out Devin Cole.
Yeah.
And I think I would want to watch it in the 90s, early 90s, like pre-smartphone, but not like too far back that I don't understand the world. Like I still want cars, you know, I still want like sure. microwaves and stuff, but sure. Yeah, no phones.
You still want to get home safe.
Yeah. Sure. I want some similarities, like phones. Yeah. Outhouses are on though.
And then a food or beverage or both that would best represent you that would be served that evening.
Got it. Food, any arrangement of buffalo chicken, like buffalo chicken wrap, buffalo chicken bites, buffalo chicken salad, you name it, I'll eat it. And then probably iced tea, but not the American like cold tea stuff. I want that sweet stuff.
No, you want the Nest tea.
I want that nasty goodness.
Oh, man. I got to say, Nesty, for those maybe on the pod that know, definitely some friends, favorite drink of all time of mine. And you mentioned the buffalo chicken wraps as well, some of my favorite stuff of all time.
Yeah?
Okay. Oh, man.
Okay, wicked.
Yeah, we'll have to have those both. Sometime.
Yeah. Cool. Well, listen, I appreciate you having me on, man. This is exciting.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. This is how we wrap it up. Thanks for being the guest on, yes, the 71st episode of the Cloud Machine Podcast.
You say that every time, the guest on, yes, the 71st, or is that just today?
No, just today. I think that's the first time I say that.
Okay, Rick, it's a good tag.
Yeah, good tag. It was so insightful to know a little bit more about you. Yes, we've worked with the Devin Camp, but just getting to know your a little bit more of the origin story and where you're at in the music industry from your perspective is great.
Cool.
I'd like to invite the people to go check out Full House Management on Instagram for more information, to get into contact, whatever you'd like. Also go follow Devin Cole and Jesse Gold while you're at it too. Also want to thank those who have been listening to the Cloud Machine Podcast since the beginning, or maybe this is your first episode. So thank you for listening. We'd like to keep this platform as interactive as it can be. So please leave your questions, comments down below. Please like, subscribe, do the whole thing to keep in touch and to stay knowledgeable about what's happening in the industry. We do this for y'all in regards to, you know, we don't believe that there's an adequate resource on what's actually happening in the industry and what the individuals in the industry are going through and have gone through. And we think it's really important to share that information and experience with the people that are currently in the industry, want to be in the industry, or are just interested by it. So thanks, everybody. Manny, do you have any final thoughts?
No, I don't.
Fantastic.
No, I don't. Have a good one. Thank you so much for the time.
All right, folks. Thanks. And as always, stay safe and see you next week. Bye.